Hello, women's wellness community. I am your host, Lucy Copinu. I am joined by my lovely co-host, Nahal Horn. This is your space where we discuss everything women's wellness, our own personal transformation journey, and we also sprinkle in some wellness practices that we do on a daily basis, and our guests also get to share with us their wellness practice. So like I said, this is your community where we get together, joined by our warm cup of tea or coffee. So please get yours because we all have ours and we hope you enjoy the conversation. So today I have a very special guest who's very dear and near to my heart, Dr. Samantha DeAndrade. She is an OBGYN who is currently leading subspecialty training in urogynecology and pelvic reconstructive surgery at Harbor UCLA in Los Angeles. Not only does she hold a medical doctorate degree, she holds a master degree in public health from these two amazing institutions, Brown University and Harvard University. She has currently been focusing her research on health disparities and workforce gender equality in urogynecology. Dr. Samantha DeAndrade is passionate about raising the awareness and the burden of pelvic floor disorders in developing countries and has spent some time in Ghana as well as Cabo Verde, which her family is from, and also, you know, discussing some of the unique challenges that are faced there. And she's joined here to tell us all about her journey, how she's been very active in helping in these areas. So thank you, Samantha DeAndrade, for joining us today. We are so excited and honored to have you on.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. And I hope that that was just a glimpse of who you are as a person. And you can tell us definitely more about you, right? So I'm going to dive right in with my first question. I really do want to know, what inspired your passion for public health? Was there a need that you noticed and you felt that, you know, it was something that you wanted to help, and why?
I think for me, it started in medical school. You learn that, so medical school and the training of doctors is good for treating people who are sick. It is not as good for keeping people healthy. And I think that is a big difference. Health is a multifaceted thing. I don't think doctors necessarily are the experts in maintaining health, but I also learned, it is pretty sobering that, you know, much of what people come to you with, like, it was a function of where they live, what traumas they were exposed to, what food they have available to them, what their work is like, financial insecurity and things like that. A lot of it related to their built environment and what environmental stressors they're exposed to. So long and short of it is not a whole lot has to do with your 15 minutes with them in the clinic. And so I wanted to dig into that because it wasn't content to keep it as, like, you know, a chapter in my medical school textbook. You know, I really wanted to dig in to what was behind that because I also was raised in a community that did not have a lot of health literacy, that didn't have a lot of means, that were immigrants in a new country and, you know, experienced racism and patriarchy. And I saw a lot of those patterns growing up, and I didn't have the language to talk about them. But as I was going through medical school as a student, I was like, this is really important. like you're missing a lot here. You don't have any idea what this patient's home life is like, and you're wondering why she's having X, Y, and Z complaint, you know? And so I took a little detour and applied to public health schools. I found this great program at Harvard, and they like paid for me to go. So I took a year away from medical school to just focus on public health, and it was phenomenal. It was like the best year of being a student, but also I think they really appreciated having the perspective of somebody who was undergoing medical training. It's not that uncommon that doctors are getting these dual degrees now with public health and your main doctorate. So that is encouraging, but you know, it's a relatively new sort of interest that medicine is taking to this like convergence of public health and medical training. But I was glad to be kind of in that wave because I think it has made me a better clinician. It's made me a better person, and it's definitely informed the research that I do right now. So it's like one of the better decisions I made in life, you know?
Yeah, that's such a unique approach to it, right? So with that, do you feel like it makes you more relatable and kind of like makes your, helps your, I should say not make you, helps your clients, you know, trust you more, right? Because you can relate to them and they're trusting you to help them because you understand what they're going through. Do you feel like that's made your experience with that a lot easier and better?
Yeah, it must be. I think because I learned so much more about what to ask patients. I think a lot of my relatability though is just kind of that the community that I grew up in, and so it's hard to say was it the degree alone that did that, probably not, but I think it definitely made me a better clinician. I think I ask better questions, and I think most importantly it's made me a better like professional in advancing like research on these environmental stressors, talking to my colleagues about how important it is to consider these things. I think probably the biggest impact is actually just in my sphere, and maybe a little bit less so with patients. But I think that is because most of like why I relate so well to patients, I think, has nothing to do with school.
Wow. I love that answer. Yeah.
I'm like you just already have such a warm, like comforting vibe about you. And I mean, you know, you've got the culture, you know, you're a beautiful woman. I'm wondering, what are some of the hurdles that, did you face any hurdles as a woman in the medical field, as a woman doctor? Were there challenges that you noticed? Is there anything that you can tell us about? And also, were there advantages?
Right.
Yeah. For sure. For sure to both. But I think let's start with medical school. I think the majority of medical students come from wealth or means or families where a lot of their family members or maybe even their parents, maybe even their grandparents were doctors. You know, none of my grandparents went to school, you know, so we're already like that vastly different world that we came from. But, you know, so I think that the first culture shock for me in medical school was to be confronted by so much privilege and people around with so much more social capital. I just constantly felt like everybody knew something that I didn't, you know, in terms of how to be successful and how to like set yourself up. And then as you're going through medical training, you are where you are. So you're, you know, in medical school, but you're constantly thinking about the next step. The next step after medical school is to go to residency, which is where now that you're a minted doctor, now you have to learn how to be a doctor within a specific field. And that can be an additional, you know, 3 to 9 years. It depends on what you choose. But that's your stepping stone to get to independent practice. And then once you're in residency, and you're working and things, but you're also thinking about the next step. And there are things and decisions you have to make along the way to really set yourself up for success. And I just constantly felt like, I don't know what I'm doing. And I don't know, like, how to get myself where I need to be. Like, I clearly need help, and not so much like with the academics and like learning the body. That was actually easier in some ways because it's straightforward. Like, you get taught this, you study it, you do well. But there's also this like hidden curriculum of like how you actually advance to the next level and get the residency spot that you want or the job that you want. And that has almost nothing to do with your academic performance. So, you know, being somebody who didn't really understand that or have like really like personal people to ask, that was probably the biggest challenge. That started in medical school, but it sort of continues even today. So that is, I think it's not unique to me. You know, a lot of people feel this way coming from different sorts of backgrounds, and they have their sort of similar varieties of this experience. But I would say that that more so than anything was sort of the biggest disadvantage I felt in terms of being a woman in medicine. I think if I had a dime for every time somebody asked me if I was a nurse or, you know, any number of other roles in the hospital that's not doctor, I think I could retire early. But so there's that. So there's that because I'm a woman, because I look young, you know, so there's that. And there's nothing wrong with the field of nursing or anything else, but we all know that they're only asking because we expect nurses to be women and we expect doctors to be men still, even though our workforce is a lot more balanced this day and age. So I think you have to develop a thick skin to get through those kinds of, you know, comments. But it you know, it steals you, I guess, for other interactions. And then in terms of advantages, I think, you know, I think being relatable has really gotten me a long way. I've never been good at pretending I'm something I'm not. So I just show up as I am. And I think that for some patients, that's very like freeing in the room. Like they feel like they can be honest, and they feel like they don't have to be embarrassed about, like, they didn't take their medication that I prescribed to them because they were busy, you know, they didn't like cut out coffee. I tell my patients all the time, like, I'm telling you, you need to stop drinking coffee, but I have a venti every day. So I understand that that's really our decision. So things like that, I think, you know, being a woman of color, being a woman from, you know, an immigrant community, they kind of lends itself to you being a little bit more relatable with patients, especially patients who also fit those profiles.
Yeah. I love that. Absolutely. I love to hear about these images because we don't really focus enough on, okay, we get it. There's obviously a lot of hurdles and disadvantages, right? But I love that you shared, okay, these are my superpowers and I'm choosing to use those superpowers to help my community, you know, to be relatable, to be able to hear what the needs are. So thank you for sharing that. That was really enlightening. I enjoyed it a lot. Now that we're in the topic of culture, talk about your time spent in Ghana and Cabo Verde, which are very two distinct countries, and you were able to go there and do the work. We were so curious. We want to hear all about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're two very different experiences. Ghana was an opportunity I had during residency to work with a pelvic reconstructive surgeon who was trained and works there. And just as a background, that subset of OBGYN or gynecology is entirely focused on the pelvic floor. But do you know what I mean when I say pelvic floor? I feel like most people don't.
We want to hear from you.
Here and there.
Yeah, you tell us. Okay. I don't know.
Definitions. Definitions are very crucial. So that way we're all listening to the same thing. So yes, please.
That's a good way to put it. Okay, so if you imagine your pelvis is in a bowl, right, that you have a pelvic bone, which is sort of shaped like the sides of a bowl, and the bottom of the bowl are really your muscles and ligaments that hold up the organs in the pelvis, which are your rectum, the vagina, the uterus, if you have one, and the bladder, right? And so over time, as women age and as they go through different insults to the pelvic floor, those muscles and ligaments and supporting structures weaken. And so women can have a variety of issues that impact their quality of life, like you may have prolapsing of any of those organs in the pelvis into the vagina. So most women will have more than one organ that's sort of falling into the vagina. And people can have urinary incontinence, and they can have fecal incontinence, and they can have, you know, any kind of disfigurement from having gone through childbirth, for example. So there are lots of things that can go wrong with the pelvic floor over time. So that is the reason that I'm getting subspecialty training now. When I was a resident and sort of thinking about going into this field, I was working with a pelvic reconstructive surgeon in Ghana, and we did fistula surgery, and we would do prolapse surgery overseas. And he was based in Accra, the capital, but he would do certain assignments in more rural parts of Ghana. He would like make them aware that he was coming. He had sort of worked with the same people at these sites over and over, but he'd say, okay, I'm coming for this week and or 2 weeks. Can you line up a bunch of patients for me to see, and I can see if I can operate and help them? And so he took me on a couple of these trips over the course of 4 weeks, and we got to help. I think we operated on like 40 women or something. It was insane in that amount of time. And most of the women, maybe a quarter of them, had fistula. Fistula is an abnormal connection between two organs that shouldn't be connected. So it could be between the vagina and the bladder, or the vagina and the rectum, the uterus and the bladder. I mean, it could be all sorts of things. And in the developing world, a lot of why that happens is because difficult childbirth can happen with like nobody around, or with unskilled attendants around, and like nobody really helping you to birth a baby. And so you can have a lot of injury that never really heals well, and then it can form like a abnormal connection. And then women may have like constant leaking of urine or constant leaking of feces. And you can imagine it's just such a debilitating thing to have happen to you, and it usually happens in young women of reproductive age, right? So it's just terrible. So we did a lot of surgeries correcting that issue. We did surgeries correcting prolapse, and I got to learn about how healthcare is delivered in places that are generally of low resources, with the population, but also within the government, and where access to care is really not a given, especially for things that are considered elective, like GYN, the majority of GYN surgery. And that's like a whole different conversation. Is it really elective quality of life, or is it like a medical need, right? But so that was that experience there. In Cabo Verde, I went with a group of fellow physicians who are of Cape Verdean descent. And we partnered with a hospital in the main island of Cabo Verde, trying to start an exchange of knowledge and of training with physicians on the ground over there. And so I went as part of the GYN contingent. And again, we saw patients, we did some operations, we developed some relations with the gynecologist there. And we, you know, have a plan to go back every so often in a year. And I think my focus with them is to try to really build up skills in laparoscopic surgery, which is minimally invasive surgery. So instead of like having a big scar and really cutting people open to fix either emergent or non-emergent issues, you can use like a little camera and very small incisions and instruments outside the body to conduct surgery. It's the way that most surgery is conducted in more developed places, but you know, we have actually the technology to do so in Cabo Verde. We just are lacking skilled people to, you know, to teach, and so that they can continue to teach themselves, sort of thing. So very, very different, both though related to women's health, women's surgery, and trying to get women who traditionally don't have access to pelvic floor, or maybe even general gynecology, to be honest, you know, access to people who are interested in wanting to help them, basically. That's how I would sum it up.
How do we follow your journey? Or I want to know more. Is there like a film? Is there like an Instagram page? Do you have like a TikTok where you talk about your experiences with your travels, and especially the medical field in, you know, countries that still need more help and development. Yeah.
You know, I don't document it.
Oh, my God. Can we come to you and document it?
If you know of an intern or somebody who wants to create this content, sure. But
well, let's put it out there. If anybody's interested, it's DeAndre. Right?
DeAndre, or we DeAndrati is how we would say it in our country. But I've gone by both my whole life, so it's all good. But
if it is interest, we will send them your way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very interesting to watch. Yes. I definitely agree.
Oh my gosh. I mean, while you were talking about like women who have experienced, you said insults to like the pelvic floor or birth trauma. One trauma I want to talk about that I personally experienced and many of my friends have experienced is like postpartum depression and anxiety. It's something that we don't talk enough about. I would love to hear whether you've had any experience with it, whether there's any way that we can raise more awareness, or just like, I would love to know your thoughts about this subject.
Yeah, it is super important. I don't have personal experience with it, but I was on high alert because I know how common it is. Yeah. Things that put you at risk for it. And, you know, the majority of like the really hard stories I've seen with postpartum depression and anxiety are patients I've seen or even coworkers who've really struggled with it. But it is super important. It is underfunded. It's under-researched. It is not talked about enough. Although I will say I have noticed more information out there with the rise of social media. I will say that. And that is a good thing. I think we're starting to normalize that this is something that women experience. And whereas 10 years ago, maybe it's not something you want to talk about because everyone expects you to be thrilled that you have a baby.
Yeah.
And both things can be true. You can be thrilled that you have a baby and love your baby, but also be struggling with depression and or anxiety and or psychosis, which we never talk about, but is also not uncommon and is really scary to deal with on your own. Psychosis is when you have like thoughts or visions that are very intrusive and you can't control them and can lead you to do things that are really out of character for you. I have horror stories with postpartum psychosis, and that is really hard to deal with by yourself. You really need to be, you know, under the care of a physician or a team. Often requires a lot of therapy, medication, just kind of not surveillance, but sort of like you need people to help you get through psychosis. A lot more common would be depression and anxiety. And it doesn't always have to be treated with medications, although that can help. But I think one thing that is really, really powerful is just acknowledging that this is something that women struggle with. And it's not any reflection on your character or your mental wellness. It's like a true biologic change that's happening in this time in your life where your body is changing like the most it ever will in your lifetime for most of us in such a short amount of time. I think if me went through pregnancy and postpartum, I think the whole world would be built differently. I really do feel
true.
That way.
It's like but women to the system, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And then we're like expected to just go back to normal life. Like it's a huge change. It's huge.
I don't think that our society is healthy for mothers because we don't have villages. We don't have living with grandparents. We don't have all the help and support. And we're expected to get back to work, get back into shape, clean the house, cook food, and do it all without our village.
Exactly. I've had patients who had to go back to work after 2 weeks. I was like, you're not even healed.
Yeah.
You're not even healed. Who is like encouraging or allowing you to go back? Like somebody should step in and be like, please don't come back to work, you know? But of course, it's not that simple. You know, everybody's got to earn a living and we don't have paid leave in the U.S., which is inhumane. That's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah, all that to say, you're totally right. There's such a lack of support. And it's interesting you say that. I don't think I really appreciated that until I went through like the postpartum period myself, and I was like, I'm flapping in the breeze here. Like there's nothing. And, you know, we were lucky to have our moms come and help with the baby. So at least there's a third adult in the house, but I had to go back to work after like 2 months, which I also think is too early. And it was just like so hard. Your mind share is different. You know, you're thinking about a whole other slew of problems on top of your normal demanding job. And breastfeeding, if you choose to breastfeed, or pumping, it's just, it's a lot. It's a whole lot. And I think to your point, there's not a lot of support or accommodation for moms who are either pregnant or postpartum. They're just
and this was really relevant to you, Samantha, because you have a 8-month-old baby. So you're actually speaking from a very
a minute.
Oh my
God.
I'm in it.
Within this conversation, as you said, you had the awareness and that kind of helped you to navigate. So you kind of had like these parameters to follow, like, oh my goodness, I'm starting to feel this way. This is what it means. Do you feel like education, more education around it, more awareness around it, will kind of help mitigate this kind of situation? I'm not saying it'll, you know, make it go away completely, but do you find that to be helpful?
I think so. I think, you know, for assuaging you of the guilt that you might feel for having these feelings or these thoughts, I think just somebody telling you that it is very, very common to be feeling what you're feeling and having the thoughts that you're having can be a great relief for a lot of people who aren't aware of the depth of how serious postpartum depression and anxiety are. I think education can help us with that a lot. If you see it more on TikTok and Instagram and at your doctor's office and your friends are talking about it, I think you feel so much less alone. And I also think that you're more likely to seek help when you need it. So I think education can help in a lot of different ways, but those two ways I think stand out the most to me. So we should be talking, we just should talk about it all the time. I really believe that.
We should normalize it. Something that it should be more normalized. It's not, there's no shame. Like you said, it's not a character flaw. It's not that there's something wrong with you.
Right.
It's a normal process. And anytime we normalize something, we make it okay. And then we can then get the help that we need.
Right.
So I do love that. And that brings me to my next question. Awesome. Your personal self-care routine, right? So you're a mama of a 8-month-old. You're a doctor. Like, you do all the things, right? You're the best host I've ever met. Like, if you see a host at her house, you're like, how do you do all this? How do you do it? How do you manage it? So what are some of your personal self-care wellness routines that you can share with Nihal and I and our viewers?
Yes.
Sure. One of the things I really stuck to when I was deep in the postpartum weeds was facial skincare. So I had to like wash my face every day, put on toner, put on a moisturizer, and like that, those three steps were a lot, right? But it was enough for me to feel like a human. So I tried to maintain that. In residency, it was about getting my nails done every 3 weeks, even though it was a little impractical. But, you know, it was my time to just like sit and do nothing and think about nothing and like get something that like every time you look down on your hands, see, I'm not manicured right now. But, you know, it's just a reminder like, oh, I'm taking care of myself. I look put together, something like that. I like taking baths. And my husband knows that about me. So if I'm going through like a particularly stressful period, he reminds me that I should just like take a bath, bring me a shower, or you know, the bath bombs or whatever.
Aww.
Things like that. Tries to like take care of the baby in the house or whatever else is taking my attention at the time. And he tries to facilitate that for me. So I think there's something really nice and soothing about just sitting in warm water, especially with a glass of wine. And yes.
I got that wine.
Candles,
chocolate.
You have like a board you put over your bathtub.
You know it.
I have
in the bathroom. It's a set of candles. All of it. I think we deserve to treat ourselves. I really do think that. If I were, you know, in a perfect world, I'd probably, you know, Peloton more often than I do. But, you know, before I had a baby, that was like a really nice thing that I was pretty consistent with. That's what self-care looks like for me. Oh, in a super perfect world, I would be like making time to read or journal every night too.
Wow.
That hasn't happened in a long time.
You said the magic word. That always
Don't get this recorded. That is our love language.
That means you have to join our next journaling workshop.
I need to go to the last one. I forget what was going on at the time, but I think you were having a baby or something.
Something baby was happening.
It could have been that. It had to have been important, clearly.
Call the past for the next 2 years.
Okay. I need you to hold me accountable, actually.
Workshop, you need this. You know, you need this.
Yeah, exactly.
Self-care.
That's true. It's when you're in the weeds is when you really need to do the self-care.
That's when you need it. It's like, oh, I don't have time. That's when you really need the time to do it. I do agree with that.
That's
absolutely. Because you can always make time. There's always a little bit of time.
There's always something that is not as important as you think. Yeah. Like, you just really have to prioritize, like, this 30 minutes is going to be for me, and the laundry is just not going to get folded today, and that's okay. You know?
Yeah. Oh, totally. There's always a pile of laundry somewhere in the house.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Also part of that practice, like keeping yourself organized and asking for help. Yeah. Those two things too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I would agree. It helps to have a good partner. That helps a lot. Choose them wisely.
Especially when they need to take a bath. Yes. Keep him.
Yeah. I'm thinking about it. I'm considering keeping him around.
Brownie points. You're racking them up over here. I was listening to something today. They said the most important decision you'll ever make in life is who you choose your partner to be. And I could not agree more, right? Because your mom and daddy, they go away, your children go away. But the person, your person, is there with you. So, at that point, choose your partner wisely. Like, find your home. So, thank you.
Yes.
Wow, this has been very amazing. And I told you what to expect from the beginning. She is just phenomenal.
I have so many more questions, but we're going to have to do part two.
You can do one more, Nihal, if you want, before I close it out. Let's do it. Honest question.
So we're talking about the pelvic floor. And, you know, we've all had babies here, and I'm sure a lot of our viewers are moms as well.
Mm-hmm.
Should we start doing pelvic floor exercises? Because I can't do jumping jacks anymore without, you know, feeling a little tickled,
right? Yes. Yes. Okay. So, yes, we should be doing pelvic floor exercises. Absolutely. In France, they routinely send women to pelvic floor physical therapy after 6 weeks after
vaginal birth.
Yeah, because they understand that there was a big insult to the pelvic floor if you've delivered vaginally. But even if you like went through labor, but it ultimately ended up having a C-section, it's a lot for your pelvic floor to endure. And just like any other muscle in your body that needs to heal and rebuild itself, you have to give it some mind share and work on it. Otherwise, over time, it's going to lose its supporting structure So my advice would be, if you can get into pelvic floor physical therapy, to have a professional work with you and strengthen those pelvic floor muscles, teach you how to do the exercises. That's like A++.
Like how- Kegels.
Yeah, Kegels. Exactly. Oh, what I'm talking about are Kegels.
What does that look like? Can you give us an example? So that's good, right? Yeah. And you can
do Kegel now.
You can do that.
Yeah.
In your office. Yeah.
And nobody has to know.
Nobody has to know.
Practice them. Right. You practice them 3 times a day and just do like 5 repetitions of it. I think you're going to do much more than most people do. And you can help gain back some control of the leaking that happens when we cough, sneeze, jump, exercise, that kind of stuff, or you can help prevent those problems from developing. But it is so, so common. Over the age of 45, it's 1 in 3 women. 1 in 3 who have this issue.
Oh my goodness. I am getting pretty close.
We do.
Yeah. If you start talking about it, you realize like a lot of people have this issue as well. So yes, I would say mind your pelvic floor. You don't have to go to physical therapy, but if you can, that's amazing. If not, there's a lot of resources out there on how to strengthen your pelvic floor, how to do a good Kegel, and then just try to practice them 3 times a day.
Done. I'm going to doctor's orders.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doctor's orders. My Kegels.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That was beautiful.
I'm so glad you asked.
Yeah, I felt very comfortable. You have the best bedside manner. I felt like I could ask you that.
Thank you.
That's like you really high compliment. That was amazing. No, yeah. I love that you asked that. That was amazing. Yes, great reminder. So I like to close out our conversation with this last question. However you feel comfortable, you may close your eyes. Sam, if you were to write yourself a love letter, how would you begin?
I would say, my dear Sam, because we should always show ourselves a little love, you are braver than you think, because it takes a lot of courage to live by your conviction and your moral compass. And no matter what life has thrown at you thus far, you haven't strayed from that, and it has always served you well. So my wish for you is to continue to carry that moral compass and that light as you move forward in life. Love, Sam.
Oh my gosh, that was so beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. I felt that. I heard that, you know, it was like, so it's such a great reminder, you know, for all of us. You know, sometimes we forget, we do a lot, and we don't take a pause and to recognize and acknowledge ourselves for all the beautiful things, and just being courageous, you know, and showing up with a full heart, open heart. And that's exactly what you're doing. And we thank you for all of your work. Truly, we are so grateful for everything that you do. We need representation.
Thank you.
We need it. Here you are. You're showing up and you're delivering. So we thank you.
No, thank you for having me on the show, because otherwise, like, I don't actually get to express this. So it's very good for me as well, especially. But
yeah,
absolutely. Love being part of this community. So thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes.
Yes.
And with that, is there any other way that we can get a hold of you? Do you have social media? Do you have Instagram? Is there any, if you don't want to share, that's fine. At least we'll see you here. But if you do, let us know.
Yeah, you can tag me on Instagram when you post this podcast. It's just a personal profile. It's nothing polished at all. But, you know, if you can bear with me, maybe someday I'll be able to talk more about what I'm up to. That's a goal of mine, but, you know, life.
No, but I think the most important thing is that you are doing the work, right? So that is all we here care about, and that is what matters to us. Polish, no polish, you
come
know,
as you are.
Enough you're doing. Yes.
Absolutely. I love that. Yes, feel free to tag me. Yay.
So there you go. And to our listeners, we appreciate you so very much. It's been so amazing being on this platform. We appreciate your patience while we rack up the followings and the numbers and things. But the ones that have been with us since the very beginning, we are so grateful. And tell all your good friends about us. And we hope you find value in all of our amazing stories that we are able to share. Until the next time, be well.
Bye.